Welcome to Focus on the Upstate, a program dedicated to informing you about organizations that serve our community and how you can get involved with them. Here's your host, Chris Evans.
Good morning and welcome to Focus on the Upstate, a pre-recorded production of Entercom Communications. My name is Chris Evans and this is episode 8 of the COVID Chronicles, which we've been doing now apparently for 8 weeks. Today, my guest is Dr. Will Cobb, the chair of the Department of Surgery at Prisma Health Upstate. Good morning, doctor.
Good morning.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. You're on here today. We've had a variety of doctors. If I'm not mistaken, this is your first run on the program. So, well, I'm going to start with a question that I normally ask just to give you a chance to introduce yourself. But you're here because you are the chair of the Department of Surgery, and that's what we're going to be talking about today. So let me start by just asking you, what do you do and who do you do it for?
So my name's Will Cobb, as you said. I'm the chair of Department of Surgery at Prisma Health Upstate, and I have the honor of representing and managing a group of roughly 125 surgeons. We're broken up over 13 different divisions, and so we have general surgeons, we have cardiac or heart surgeons, ear, nose, and throat surgeons, colorectal surgeons, vascular surgeons, urologists, those that specialize in pediatric surgery as well. So lots of different types of surgeons that take care of specific patient populations.
That's a whole lot of surgeons.
Yes, sir.
It occurs to me that somebody who is not in the medical field might just think surgery is surgery. Why do you need all these different specialists? It actually takes quite a bit of training to do a specific kind of surgery, which is why you have so many different kinds of surgeons.
That's correct. And general surgery is what most people think of when they talk about a surgeon, and that's usually...
Those are the ones they make the TV shows about, right?
That's right. That's right. And those are the folks that take care of hernias and any type of abdominal problems, if you need your appendix removed or your gallbladder removed or things like that. But our department includes neurosurgeons that I didn't mention earlier. Again, the pediatric surgeons, plastic surgeons. I mean, anyone that is skilled in the field of surgery, but they've chosen to further specialize and take care of, you know, just individual patient populations.
Well, and I guess it's nice to hear that we have so many surgical options at Prisma Health. You don't have to get referred to another hospital, maybe even out of state, to get the kind of care you need.
That's correct. We pretty much provide every surgical specialty that a patient could need. The only group that we don't have would be transplant surgeons, but everyone else we have and are represented well.
Well, and part of the reason that we're talking about this is because with all of the coronavirus emergency that's going on, Prisma has had a policy of suspending some of the non-essential surgeries, what I guess people refer to as elective surgeries. And that's what we're here to talk about is that policy and moving forward and when things might get back to normal.
Correct. So, you know, roughly the third week in March when the COVID pandemic was imminently going to hit our community pretty hard. The plans were calling for potentially hundreds of ventilated patients that would be infected with the COVID virus. And so we had to really evaluate our deferrable surgeries. The term elective implies almost that it's optional, but elective really just means that the patient and their surgeon elected to have that procedure to take care of their ailment. But there were procedures that were not time sensitive, meaning that you could delay the procedure potentially 4 to 6 weeks without harming the patient. This, of course, did not include emergency procedures or urgent surgeries. And a lot of the cancer procedures that obviously needed to be addressed, those were still taking place. But we evaluated the situation for two reasons. One, obviously, we did not want to expose patients to potential infection, as well as we needed to preserve a lot of precious resources in case our system was hit with a lot of infected patients and we were going to need PPE, which is, you know, a lot of folks are familiar with that now, but essentially personal protective equipment, which is the mask right. and the gowns and the things that folks need to protect themselves and taking care of COVID positive patients. And also we couldn't fill up our hospitals and couldn't fill up the beds if we were going to have hundreds of folks with the COVID virus.
Right. Well, the PPE that you mentioned, it's kind of the things that people would take for granted hospitals would just have on hand, and then all of a sudden they became very scarce and very precious.
Correct. And, you know, we always, of course, wear masks and gowns in the operating room, but we don't wear the specific type of mask that the CDC requires for the high-risk procedures. If you're coming into contact with a COVID-positive patient, if you're doing a procedure where there's a lot of aerosolization, meaning that you're in the airway or you're right up near the nasal area where they're getting a lot of the respiratory droplets. So the N95 masks are the ones that create a better seal. And so those are really required for patients that are, and for caregivers rather, that are dealing with patients in those scenarios.
Well, and again, like you mentioned, back at the beginning of March or the middle of March, all of this was still sort of theoretical. I mean, we were relying on models that we weren't even sure were entirely correct. I mean, there's got to be some variance, some uncertainty that's built into them. But now in retrospect, I happened to look at the South Carolina DHEC website before this interview and saw that currently, as we are recording this, there are 484 coronavirus patients that are in hospitals in South Carolina, not just here in the upstate, but in South Carolina, all over the state. And I believe the figure, I'm not going to remember it off the top of my head, but it was around 6,600 hospital beds that were occupied. And that's just not, I mean, it's not even 10% of people in the hospital have coronavirus or are hospitalized for coronavirus. All of the curve flattening that we were trying to do, was it really necessary?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. And of course, we probably won't know the answer to that months or maybe even years after all this has passed us, hopefully. We've been fortunate, of course, in the upstate and actually in our entire state. We haven't seen the huge numbers like you've seen in New York and
yeah,
in New
big
Jersey.
Cities,
and,
yeah.
Correct. More populous
New Orleans,
areas. Yes, sir. And so we've been fortunate in that sense. You know, yes, the restrictions were pretty austere and folks having to stay home and businesses having to close. And I guess what we'll never know is, did we lessen the curve or lessen the number of infected patients that we would have gotten by implementing these measures? You certainly would like to think so. And I think you would rather err on the side of being overly cautious in this scenario than to be in a situation where, you know, if our hospitals were currently overrun and we weren't prepared because we didn't take the necessary precautions. And so it's difficult to say. It's a little bit easier now that we're, you know, 5 or 6 weeks into this. But fortunately, you're correct. We have not seen the significant spike in the concern for the hundreds and even thousands of ventilated patients that they were predicting for us.
Well, and that's kind of my point, is that we were doing all of this to make sure that the hospitals themselves didn't get overwhelmed with coronavirus patients in addition to the patients that they would have had otherwise, you know, for any reason. And in one sense, I guess it seems to have worked. You guys didn't get overwhelmed at all.
Correct. No, you're right. And in that sense, it did work. And the concern, however, is that particularly in surgery, over the last 6 weeks, since we have backed off significantly on the deferrable surgeries, we've in essence not been taking care of, you know, roughly 60 to 70% of our community. And so these are patients that have surgical diseases that need to be addressed. Yeah, they were possible to be delayed for a few weeks, but the farther we put these off, we're really just not taking care of that segment of our community to the best of our ability. And that's concerning, and we're certainly getting to the point where we have to start taking care of these folks as well.
Now, that seems like a surprising number to me, 60 to 70%. And I want to make sure that I understood what you were talking about. You're not talking about 60 to 70% of the population of the upstate that needs surgery. You're talking about 60 to 70% of the people who need surgery got delayed. Is that right?
Correct.
Okay. So I just wanted to make sure I understood that. And
yes, sir. Well,
it's
a low point. Yeah, and I'm sorry, maybe I wasn't clear with that. But yes, we essentially, our surgical volumes reduced by about 60 to 65%. So in essence, we weren't taking care of, you know, the surgical problems.
Two-thirds,
by deferring
basically.
The time. There you go. Yes, sir.
Gotcha. Now, I thought it was interesting also the distinction that you made between elective surgeries and deferrable surgeries. Elective, you kind of described as being, well, this is something that the patient and the doctor have elected to do as a treatment for whatever condition the patient has. I assume that's as opposed to some sort of a medicinal treatment.
Correct. And you know, deferrable implies that you have the luxury of a little bit of time. And so, you know, obviously emergencies, automobile accidents,
right.
Things that come in through the emergency department, those have to be taken care of instantly. Then you have more urgent procedures, and that would be someone that came in, let's say, that had potentially a bowel obstruction from a hernia, or, you know, they had an infection or something that needed to be addressed fairly timely, maybe not within hours, but within, you know, a day or so. And then you have a group of surgeries that are more time sensitive, and those would largely be your cancer diagnoses that you obviously don't want to tell someone you're not going to do their biopsy or you're not going to remove their cancer for, you know, 2 months when that could potentially worsen their condition. And so those would be more obviously needing to be addressed and time sensitive. And those were still being done obviously during all of this. But, you know, I'm talking about procedures where, you know, the surgeon and the patient had a conversation and decided that we could put this off for a few weeks and not create any adverse complications or problems for you.
Take on the risk of going into a hospital where, you know, there might be infectious people inside.
Right, exactly.
Well, and I think it's interesting what you're talking about as far as the deferral of these surgeries. Obviously, as you mentioned, you know, if somebody comes into the emergency room and they got a bone sticking out of their leg, they need surgery right then.
That's right.
We're not deferring that at all because that's got to get fixed.
And just like someone who comes in with an ongoing stroke or that's having a heart attack and that needs a cardiac bypass or needs to have their stroke care and have the clot removed, those are obviously going to be done. So yes, we're not talking about these.
So Prisma has been taking care of those sorts of surgeries along throughout this whole coronavirus pandemic emergency, but then the deferrable ones, and I suppose it's going to be, you know, sort of on a case-by-case basis between the doctor and the patient, how long a particular surgery can be deferred. So clearly, it appears that some of them are more deferrable than others, but eventually, will some of those eventually reach the point, I guess, with, as you mentioned, a gallbladder surgery or cancer surgery, that we really can't put this off any longer, and now you've got to come in and actually get the surgery done?
That's absolutely right. And it's a large spectrum here. I mean, you've got everything from really elective procedures. If you think about some of your cosmetic procedures that plastic surgeons perform, that, you know, those can certainly be delayed to the patient and the physician's discretion for any number of time. But if you have something like you mentioned, gallbladder disease, if you have gallstones, you know, you're having symptoms and you're having attacks related to your gallbladder, that's causing pain. And there are complications that could ensue if you did not address that gallbladder. And so, yeah, you might say, or you discuss with the patient, you know, my symptoms have kind of subsided. Yes, I can decide to wait 4 to 6 weeks because of the concerns of potential infection. But it's not like you can just ignore that and say, oh, well, we won't address your gallbladder at all. And so, to your point also, we've touched base with our patients during this. And if some of these conditions that we put off initially, if the patient became more symptomatic, was having worsening pain, more frequent attacks, obviously that had to be addressed during this time. But as long as these patients remained asymptomatic and didn't have flare-ups of their disease, we could continue to delay the surgical care that was needed.
Well, and I think you kind of touched on this a little bit, but it occurs to me that people listening, they hear Prisma Health has delayed elective surgeries. It's not quite as simple as that, as you've been describing, but that there are some surgeries, for some reason in my mind, I'm thinking nose job, that are indefinitely deferrable. You don't need to get that done until after all of this is over.
Well, it depends. You know, it depends on why you're having that procedure done. If you're having difficulty breathing, if you're having difficulties, if you have severe sleep apnea or other things that are keeping you awake at night, and it's a case by case, as you stated earlier. And if it's merely a cosmetic procedure that you're just doing for improving your looks, which, you know, arguably that's very important as well. But that's something that could be put off a little bit more as opposed to something that may cause more medical concerns and may actually adversely affect your health.
I understand also that there were some other procedures, not necessarily surgical procedures, but things like cancer screenings, mammography, or colonoscopies that were also put off just because, as you mentioned, they were deferrable. They're not necessary to do right now. They can be done later.
Correct. And so you think about mammography, that's typically women have those done yearly. And then screening colonoscopies, looking for colon cancers, those can be anywhere from 5 to 8 or 10 years between those exams, depending upon your family history and how your exams have looked previously. So, you know, if you're talking about a test that you normally get once a year or that you get every 8 years, you know, waiting 4 to 6 weeks is not going to be significantly impactful, but it is certainly something we have to follow up on and stay in touch with those patients so that they don't miss their screening, you know, during this crisis.
Well, I guess that was kind of the question that I had was it worth the risk to put those off for people who maybe have a family history of breast cancer or colon cancer or whatever? Is it worth it to put that off rather than risk catching the disease that, frankly, we still know very little about by coming into the hospital?
Correct. And that's certainly, that was a decision made by the surgeon and the patient. And obviously, every condition is going to be different. And if you have a patient with an extremely strong positive family history, and if the surgeon felt like that study needed to be ordered, I mean, these types of procedures that were determined by the radiologist or the surgeon that needed to be taking place, I mean, those were obviously addressed and done during this time as well.
You know, one of the other questions that occurred to me in regards to was it worth it to put these off? Did we really need to put off these procedures? I remember thinking about when the announcement was first made that these were going to be deferred. Isn't a hospital one of the best places that you could be? I mean, they're usually known as scrupulously clean. So really, how much risk was it going to a place like that's kept so tidy?
You're absolutely right. From a cleanliness standpoint, certainly the hospital is far cleaner and far less chance of transmitting
than say Walmart or Home Depot
or whatnot. Exactly. Than getting out to Walmart or Home Depot, where the social distancing may not have been adhered to as strictly, and you know, it's obviously more difficult to clean areas like that. But yes, and we've said that multiple times as well, that the hospital is probably much less likely place for someone to contract the COVID virus than being out and about in public. But the sense that, and again, you know, we were thinking at one time that we may be overrun and we may have hundreds
right.
of infected patients. The concern was if we were bringing in patients electively to the facility when we had, you know, hundreds of patients with known COVID virus at the same time, that potentially could have caused harm to our patients.
Well, and it's easy to, as we've said, it's easy to know all of this here in the future looking back than it is to know it in the past looking forward.
That's correct. And again, like I said earlier, I think we'd much rather be on the side of now sitting back playing Monday morning quarterback
right.
and saying, well, boy, we overreacted. You know,
yeah.
we probably deferred some of this unnecessarily than the alternative where if we had not been prepared.
The headlines would be very different if we had underreacted rather than overreacted.
That's correct. I suspect that our interview would be going a little differently.
Yeah,
yes, sir.
Indeed. Well, so now let's talk about the future. Now the big question is, when are these procedures going to start back up? When is PRISMA going to lift these restrictions? Have you already done that? Is it coming?
So we have to some degree. It's been a very slow ramp up. I mean, it's obviously, again, very cautiously being done. And we still have to be concerned that there are patients in the community that even today are testing positive, and we have to be concerned. As you stated earlier, it does appear as if the curve has flattened somewhat, and we're not seeing this dramatic rise or peak of patients, but we still have to be in tune and be aware of that. But starting the week of April the 20th, we started bringing back in some more of the procedures that couldn't wait. Any, you know, they'd already
right.
been put off for 4 weeks. And so these would be your cancer patients or your patients that were having severe pain. I know some of our orthopedic colleagues, patients that needed joint replacements and that were just, you know, having an awful lot of pain, having to take a lot of pain medications. You know, patients, again, like I said
which
earlier,
can also
more
be a
symptomatic.
Problem.
That's right. And so they were coming in slowly starting on April the 20th. And then we've just gradually ramped up each week. And we've done it, again, very cautiously and, you know, using an algorithm and trying to consider the patient comorbidities, because we do know the COVID virus seems to affect patients more adversely if they're greater than the age of 65, if they have diabetes,
yeah.
if they're immunocompromised, if they have respiratory conditions. And so we've been careful about bringing those patients back in, you know, without concern. You know, the other thing too is the risk of aerosolization of the during the procedure. And what I mean by that is the COVID virus is transmitted via a respiratory droplet. And so for our ENT colleagues, our ear, nose, and throat surgeons, they are working almost exclusively in that area. If you're doing a mass or a tumor of the airway, I mean, that's just constant. You know,
that's the worst place to get some COVID on somebody.
Exactly.
Okay.
And that is really had a significant impact on our ENT surgeons. And so for those patients that obviously need their surgical conditions dealt with, those surgeons and the whole team, they have to be in that N95 mask that we talked about earlier with the seal, as well as eye protection and you know, to make sure that they're not being exposed to the droplet during the procedure. So, you know, we've taken a very stepwise approach, as well as we've used some of the testing of our patients preoperatively, and that's been more in those high-risk procedures for the aerosolization. So, you know, our ENT procedures, our neurosurgical procedures where they work in the nasal area, and as well as our plastic surgery colleagues who take care of oral facial trauma. So if you have someone with a broken jaw and they're working in the mucosa in the mouth, things like that, we've been testing those patients prior to surgery to get hopefully a negative COVID result before proceeding.
Well, and that brings up an interesting question. What about the staff, the doctors and the support staff that are there? Have y'all been tested along during this COVID pandemic as well?
We have not. We're starting to do that next week. We have the serology testing. And so there's two different types of testing. There's the more common type I think people are familiar with is the nasopharyngeal swab. That's called a PCR test, and that tests for the RNA, which is what
the actual
makes
virus.
Up the virus.
Right.
Correct. And so you're just looking for the virus. It doesn't, all that says is that, you know, you have the virus present. It doesn't say whether or not you're contagious,
currently.
Whether or not, that's right, whether or not you're able to infect others. It just says that, yes, there's proof the virus is present. The serology is a blood test which looks for the antibodies.
Right.
And so there's been some talk of that in the news, and we have that test now. Our in-house lab has done all the appropriate testing and made sure that that is a reliable test. And so we're looking more at our team members and our workforce and staff to check the serology starting next week. But that's interesting, too, because that opens up a lot of questions as well, because we don't exactly know what that means if you have a positive antibody to the COVID virus.
Well,
it doesn't mean you're immune.
We discussed last week with Dr. Sasser the potential that some of those antibody tests could be fooled, that they're not necessarily as reliable as the PCR tests because they might show a false positive because you've got antibodies for, say, a different kind of coronavirus.
That's true. You have to, you know, because the COVID virus is a type of coronavirus.
Right.
And most of your common colds are also coronaviruses. So yes, you have to be concerned that it may not be specific for the COVID virus. The test that we have, that our lab has been doing, and the testing that they have done is shown it is pretty reliable for the COVID virus. But all these tests are going to have an inherent risk of false negatives, correct. And the PCR, even, some have reported as high as 30%. We don't believe that
high
in our lab. Yes, so you know that would be concerning if you had a patient that tested and you received a negative result when in actuality they were either positive because they hadn't turned positive yet because they were early on in their COVID infection, or, you know, was it a false negative result from the test? And then that could potentially give the providers a false sense of security.
Speaking of security, I know that one thing that makes people feel better when they're in the hospital, if they're recovering from surgery, especially when they're recovering from surgery, is to have visitors. And I know that the visitation policy for Prisma has likewise been restricted during the coronavirus epidemic that we're experiencing. But that is also starting to change, isn't it? You've got a new companion policy.
That's correct. And specifically in the surgery area, it's a very traumatic potentially time, and the patient needs to be with their family members. And so when the coronavirus pandemic was raging, the hospital had to restrict all visitors.
Right.
And so that's been difficult now that we're resuming surgical procedures to not allow patients to have a loved one or companion come with them. So we've modified that policy to allow one visitor to come with the patient, accompany them to the pre-op area. And for most of the procedures that are outpatient, then that visitor or companion can see the patient after the surgery and then take them home. If the patient does require an overnight stay, the companion has to leave, and then they need to abide by the visitation policies currently for the inpatients. But it has opened it up a little bit to allow the patient to have a visitor during surgery.
Gotcha. You know, you mentioned the things that were in the news, and I have also heard news stories about some of the hospitals around the country, frankly, have had similar policies to the ones at Prisma in terms of deferring surgeries that are deferrable, that maybe they're suffering financially now because that's a significant source of revenue for them. Can you speak at all to Prisma's financial health at the moment?
Yes, so certainly the financial concerns have been felt across the entire country, not just in healthcare, but in all small businesses. And, you know, I can't directly speak to the finances. I know there's some federal funding available, and I believe that PRISMA has applied for that. But, you know, we are clearly committed to taking care of our community, and there's been no talk of doing anything other than that. And, yes, this has significantly impacted, I'm sure, the bottom line, and kept our finance people up many long hours. But we're obviously still here. We're going to take care of all of our patients and again, start getting back to these procedures and these surgeries so that we can take care of our entire community.
As we usually mention on this program, we want to mention again the website prismahealth.org/coronavirus, where you can get all kinds of information from Prisma Health regarding coronavirus symptom checker, you know, things like that. They've also launched what I have not heard of before. Maybe it's not that new a website, but it's prismahealth.org/access. And this is for people who need to find a physician. We've talked a little bit in other programs about telemedicine and telehealth becoming much more popular now. And as I understand, that's a website where people can get in touch with doctors through Prisma Health.
Yes, correct. So those are our websites. The coronavirus link will take you to all the current CDC recommendations and any questions and answers about the coronavirus specifically. And then the access link will allow you to make appointments with physicians. You can set up virtual visits, which is the telehealth that you talked about. You could also look at the COVID tracker in there and look to see any symptoms and things like that. So yes, it has a lot of good resources around the COVID virus.
Well, thanks very much. Dr. Will Cobb, the chair of the Department of Surgery for Prisma Health Upstate, has been my guest today. Thanks again, doctor, for being here.
Thanks so much, Chris. I appreciate your time.
Well, it's been my pleasure. I'm Chris Evans, and this has been Focus on the Upstate.
You've been listening to Focus on the Upstate with Chris Evans. If you would like more information on today's topic, email Chris at cevans@intercom.com.